Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to another wonderful episode of How to Be Sound, presented by me, Rosemary McCabe, where I interview someone that I suspect is sounder than me. I know, it's a big ask. If you're not already, you can read my writing, if you decide that you like the cut of my jib, on patreon.com/rosemarymaccabe. That's patreon.com/rosemarymccabe, but because my dad's an asshole, I've got an A in my Mac. Today, I am joined by Claire Hennessy, YA and publishing queen. What is your official title?
Oh, my official title is human. We've decided to go for it because, you know, it's straightforward.
Very inclusive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of humans, anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, perhaps excluding, like, sort of other creatures, but, you know, that's a whole thing. So I usually kind of describe myself as a writer, editor, and creative writing facilitator. So to not give sort of anyone like sort of more of an edge, but like everything that I do is related to kind of to books and stories and the words and the shiny things. So yeah,
and the English language.
The language. I speak the English good sometimes. Yeah.
And do you remember the first time we met? Awkward.
Oh my god, is this like did we meet in person like at a time that I have forgotten?
I mean, you don't seem to have remembered it anyway.
Oh dear god, I am so sorry.
No, I mean, like, so this is something that I ask everyone on my podcast, right? So don't feel particularly put on the spot. But we met first in the Penguin offices.
Yes. No, I do remember that. Yes, I was like,
It wasn't a trick question. It wasn't like we've met at a time that you don't remember.
I was just about to go, I am so sorry for whatever I said or did, or, you know,
I didn't mean it. Take that style.
Yeah, because we were talking about the writing and the words and all that sort of stuff, and I am no longer working sort of with Penguin, but oh my god, like learned so much in the land of like publishing and books and like behind the scenes.
So like humble brag, Claire emailed me to say, have you thought about writing? I think it was kind of writing YA, wasn't it? Or like writing nonfiction for young adults.
Nonfiction for young adults, yeah.
Yeah.
So basically like the kind of stuff that you do sort of in the blog or now the sort of the, I mean, is it still a blog if it's on Patreon? I don't know the lingo these days.
Yeah, I don't know either. I guess it is in a sense that it's regularly published writing online. You know, that seems to be a very loose definition of a blog to me. But I guess as the years have gone by, blog has kind of become a maybe slightly pejorative term in that it feels like, oh, you're just writing a blog.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That it feels almost like you're just writing diary entries online, which actually, now that I say it out loud, is not entirely different to what I do.
But like, I think it's so funny because like we're living in an era, particularly sort of in Ireland, where it's like, oh my God, you know, sort of like this collection of personal essays by a woman is amazing, you know, and there was such a sort of, you know, like fuss made over Emily Pine's Notes to Self, and like it's a good book, but like if you've been reading sort of like women's writing online for the last 10 years, it's like, yeah, you know, like I've seen this done before, like I can appreciate this book, but like it's not doing sort of anything radical or new, you know, like there's
a
lot.
I see what
of,
you mean. It's just that publishing has kind of caught up, like paper publishing has kind of caught up with what's happening with online publishing.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I think the sort of the honesty and the rawness that you get on like a lot of, you know, sort of a lot of websites is like way more kind of interesting and exciting than what, you know, than what you might get sort of in an essay collection, you know.
Mm.
So yeah, the idea that it was like this kind of like groundbreaking thing is like, yeah, okay, like skeptical face.
Yeah, I think there's something very interesting about the kind of potential impossibilities that come with publishing online from the point of view of not being edited, and obviously that has its own problems, you know. And I'm not trying to devalue the work of an editor, and I think for a lot of people it can make a huge difference. But I think also what we see online is, like you said, so raw and unfiltered, and also written without a kind of a commercial end in mind, which is, which makes it different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I do think, you know, obviously I support the role of the editor. But I do think as well, like it is different when it's kind of personal writing, you know, and when the sort of the rawness or the roughness can actually be sort of a good thing, you know, the sort of that lack of kind of sort of a filter. And when it's sort of short form as well, you know, because like you can, like the thing I always say to people, like sort of if you're writing like a short piece, like if you're writing like sort of a short essay or a short story or whatever, like you can hold that in your head, you know, you can sort of have an idea of where it's going the whole way through. Whereas like when you're writing a book, you can't like, and that's, I mean, I think that's sort of when a lot of the sort of the editorial kind of feedback becomes really important.
Tell me about, I don't necessarily want to dwell on what you used to do because I want to talk more about what you're doing now, but when you worked at Penguin, or, you know, when you worked in a commercial publishing, what were you looking for?
So I was looking for children's and YA projects that would have been, I suppose, like interesting, but also kind of commercially viable. And that is, it's a tricky thing in a way when you're a writer as well, because you know what it's like to be on the other side of those emails saying, no.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Not for us. Or for, you know, so there might be something that you're kind of quite excited about, but it's just like, it's just not going to fit for like whatever reason that might be.
Did I send you the email that I got? I submitted some work to an agent a couple of months ago. Did I forward you the email that I got? I think we might have talked about it anyway.
I think you talked about it, yeah.
But like, speaking of kind of thanks but no thanks, it was really difficult to take.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably, I mean, I think there are probably different ways to go about it. So I'm sure, knowing you and kind of how you work and having done one of your creative writing courses, I feel like you would probably be more constructive than everyone is. You know, I also think when you're submitting stuff to a publisher or an agent, it's not their job necessarily to keep you going, if you know what I mean.
It's not, no. And I mean, I think, you know, so I think you owe it to people to be polite, but it's not the step that people should be taking if they're looking for feedback. That's the thing. Like, you know, sometimes you might get sort of a bit of feedback or a bit of kind of, you know, sort of like a PS, here's like, you know, a suggestion, or here is a, you know, sort of bit of encouragement or whatever. And like, that's great. But like, it's not the, you know, sort of the editor's main job or main priority. Like their main priority is to
say yes or no, basically.
Yeah, to say yes or no. And then to sort of be working on those yeses and making them as brilliant as they can be. You know, I think people sort of do forget that, like, you know, sort of editors aren't just like, you know, sitting there reading their submissions inbox the whole day, you know, that actually they are sort of working on other sort of projects. And I mean, like, I do still see that. I'm, you know, so I am now sort of like, kind of was sort of kind of also at the time, but one of the editors of a literary journal called Banshee. So we've just kind of finished sending out our kind of no's and our yeses. And like, there would be people where sometimes you're going like, okay, this is like, we really liked it, but it's not for us. But like, please do send us more work.
Yeah.
You can't do that for everybody. And people kind of shouldn't be expecting it. And I think sometimes people are. And like, it doesn't mean that of course you feel crap when you get a rejection. like people kind of say, like, don't take it personally. And like, I just always think that's such like nonsense. Like, of course you're going to take it personally. Like, it is something that you have made, and people are saying no to it. Like, that is, that's not a pleasant thing. Not fun.
I think there are certain things that you can make that you don't feel as such a personal attachment to. You know, like, I think there's a difference between a fine artist and a house painter, and that's not to denigrate the house painter, but the house painter isn't going to take it personally if someone's like, I really hate the colour you painted that house, or, you know, I really hate the way you did that architrave, or whatever it is. Whereas if you're working on fine art, I mean, maybe, I think it depends as well on how confident you are in
your
own.
Angry comments from house painters now, just being like, actually, I take it very personally because that was the colour she said she wanted, and I did a really good job. And
well, I mean, that's kind of it. That, you know, like, it's not so much of putting your own artistic self into it.
Yeah, it's functional, like you're fulfilling kind of requirements. Yeah.
The same way, like, an accountant, I don't think is necessarily going to get annoyed that somebody says, I don't really like the method at which you produce that result, because you're like, well, I'm still producing the result, so it actually, I don't really care if you like it. You know what I mean? If you like how I did it or not. Whereas it is different if you're a musician or an artist or even like a teacher, I think you could probably take it quite personally. I'm sure they have the worst life. I'm sure there's a lot of complaining from parents, but you could take it quite personally if parents are coming to you and saying, I don't think you're doing this right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? For sure. Tell me about Banshee. For people who don't know what a literary journal is, because I think often the term literary journal, like we would go into a shop and pick up a magazine, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
A literary journal feels more for
fancy,
them
snooty.
Instead of for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And like, it's definitely the case, I think, that some of them out there are, I suppose, more interested in the idea of like giving writers a platform that rather than, you know, sort of like creating an enjoyable reading experience. I guess what we try to do sort of with Banshee is to sort of to, you know, focus more on sort of like, you know, having it sort of be a fun thing. But of course, it does sit with the literary journals, you know, so things like the Stinging Fly or the Dublin Review. Like, I like to think of it as a kind of a selection box of new writing. So we usually publish kind of a couple of sort of kind of personal essays, short stories and poetry. But like poetry that you can actually like read and understand.
I was almost going to say, because I feel like poetry of all creative writings is the most difficult to access, or seems like feels like the most difficult to access for a lot of people.
I think so. I think a lot of it is the way that it's taught in schools.
I was going to say that, because it's drummed into you so much.
And it's treated like a riddle. It's treated like it's something that you have to sort of decode. And if you don't decode it in the right way, then you have like failed at reading poetry.
And it's your fault and you're not smart enough.
Yeah. And like, poetry is like, it's such a natural form for people, but they, you know, sort of, they do kind of like, they are taught, we are taught out of poetry, you know, because I mean, teenagers write it. I mean, like really bad poetry.
Oh my God,
like,
I used
like
to write
bad angsty poetry.
I used to write the worst angsty poetry.
Was it like, did the word like soul turn up a lot?
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. It was always like, I'm glad in hindsight that my parents never found it, because a lot of my poetry, I think, expressed suicidal ideation at a time when I did not have any experience of, you know, I had not considered suicide once by the time I was 16. I think I had just read a lot of like angsty teenage, and I thought that was very deep.
Yeah, no, it does. It does really feel like you totally romanticize it. So it is like, it's the total kind of tormented artist thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you want to be Sylvia Plath, basically.
Yeah. It was either suicide or men. Like,
oh
yes,
those are the two topics, the two great topics of teenage poetry. I should have just brought some of mine, could have compared, would have been like, oh yes, see this like same sort of, you know, tormented sort of imagery going on. Yeah. Very, very sort of common. Yeah, like I think there's a weird thing as well that sometimes I think adults do, where like they assume that like everything that sort of like their, you know, sort of that a child writes is like super autobiographical, and that if they're writing about dark material, it means that they're like,
then they must
super
be
depressed. And it's like, no, like, I mean, I think the way to think about it is like, they're in a position to be making something, you know, and depression is kind of more of a kind of state of like, yeah, I'm not going to be making anything. I'm just going to, you know.
But you know what? You know what as well? I think that's hugely gendered.
Oh, like, yes.
I mean, I remember...
Are you suggesting we live in some kind of patriarchal society? Oh, my God.
We might. I remember when I had Louise O'Neill on the podcast, and she was talking about how everybody kept saying that Almost Love, which is her second most recent novel, the other one is The Surface Breaks, which is the reimagining of The Little Mermaid. Sorry, this is not a Louise O'Neill ad, but I just wanted to clarify. So Almost Love is the one she wrote about this kind of tortuous, troubled relationship.
Yeah, with the bad man. Like, we've all had
bad
that.
Man, but also bad woman. Like, there were no good characters really in that book. But when it came out, everyone kept kind of saying, like, how much of this is tied to your own life? And you're like, how many people have asked Cullum Tobin, like, did you live in a, like, flat in Brooklyn? Like, did you travel over to Brooklyn on the boat and get terrible seasickness? Like, nobody's accusing him of... You know what I mean?
And, like, Brooklyn is, like, basically a Maeve Binchy novel. And, like... You know, I don't just mean in terms of like the subject matter. I mean like sentence by sentence, like on a sentence by sentence level. It is like, you know, you're reading it, you're going like, I've seen this stuff before. I've seen this in, you know, sort of like another great Irish writer who, you know, did not get nearly the same kind of level of acclaim. But like, it's such a common thing with writers, like men get to have imaginations and women get to have biographies, you know.
But you know, yeah, I mean, but that's also through everything, like women have to have experience to back up their thoughts.
Yes.
And women are assumed that all of their thoughts, you know, it is assumed that all of our thoughts are backed up by experience, and that the reason we are, you know, feminist is because something really bad must have happened to make you this angry.
Yeah, like, you know, like what? Like being born a woman in a like society that hates you? Ooh, maybe that.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I did this tweet thread a couple of years ago where somebody had said to me something like, God, it really seems like you hate men. And I went, interesting. I was like, well, that might be because, and I wrote this really long tweet thread about basically kind of every small microaggression that I felt I had experienced at the hands of a man, hashtag not all men, but enough men. And it got so much backlash and so much backlash from men who were going, I simply do not believe that all these things have happened to you.
Yeah, the sort of the it didn't happen kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but like men don't see it. And even sort of very liberal men are much more likely to, I think, believe the experiences of like any other sort of marginalized group.
More than women, yeah.
More than women, because women have always been, because women have always been in their lives, do you know what I mean? So like, I think it's just really difficult for them to imagine that the women that are in their lives have been living with this and have been dealing with this and have developed kind of strategies to, you know, sort of like to deal with, you know, like all these kind of microaggressions and the things that aren't, like the situations where it's like, okay, nothing bad happened, but you're always kind of aware that something bad could happen. Mm. And you're aware that the pressure is on for you to be, you know, sort of taking some kind of action against, yeah. you know, to defend yourself against yeah. that. I think it's just, it's really hard for people to get that, you know?
You know what I wonder as well? I feel as if in our culture and society, women are taught to deny their own feelings and deny their own thoughts, especially when it comes to sex and sexuality. So, you know, we're not supposed to talk about being turned on. We're not supposed to talk about wanting to have sex with somebody, like, unless we love them. We're not supposed to talk, you know, if we're thinking about teenagers, teenage girls aren't supposed to talk about their desires.
Yeah.
And so there's a certain pressure for women to be seen to deny what they want and then to kind of quote unquote give in. Do you know what I mean? So the whole yeah. thing about like, oh, I'm not going to have sex with you, and then being like, oh, well, I really wanted to, so I did, but like I told him I wasn't going to. And therefore, I think women get unfairly kind of accused of lying.
Yeah.
Like seen as the kind of tricksy gender. You know what I mean? That it's like, completely. Oh, well, like women are never being straightforward.
Completely. Yeah. And like so much sort of around sex and like even with sort of like so many kind of like consent classes, like for the young people these days, you know, the hip young people. But like so much of that is couched in.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's exactly the same kind of language where, you know, the focus is on telling young men that they need to be checking in and they need to be sort of respectful and they need to be sort of listening. And it's like women as kind of gatekeepers, you know, whereas, you know, we're not teaching sort of young women to be like, okay, right, so like, you know, don't be afraid of like making noise, you know, sort of be yeah. vocal, be
enthusiastic,
like, be like
consent.
A friend. Yeah, yeah, enthusiastic consent, like, and you know, like, I mean, I do think like sort of, you know, anyone who sort of thinks like, you know, sort of like consent is like totally sort of unsexy is like, I just worry about the kind of sex that they're having, because like, I think there is nothing as sexy as somebody going like, you know, sort of in response to like, sort of, oh, do you want that? Someone kind of like purring, kind of like, oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like that is sexy. This sort of like, you know, sort of like tricking somebody into having sex or tricking somebody into thinking that you didn't want it. It's like, what? Like, what kind of bad sex are you having here?
Or like,
you
know? Or like during it being like, this is so sexy. I don't think he's that into it at all. Like, what? I was that attractive. Tell me, not to move on from, I don't know how I end up bringing so many conversations around to consent and feminism. And I mean, it's a big theme in my life.
It's nearly like you're living in the world or something. And like, you're moving through it as like, as a woman with opinions, like that might be something to do. I don't know.
Nearly like that. Let's talk a bit about Big Smoke. So you are co-director
and co-founder of the Big Smoke Writing Factory, which is a creative writing school in Dublin City Centre. As of next month, we are 10 years old. Ooh.
Oh, wow.
I know.
So what age were you when you founded it?
I was 23. I should note I'm like the younger of the founders. So I co-run it with a kind of writer and performer and theatre maker, Nicole Rourke. And I seem to do this thing where, you know, so if it's like, yeah, just like start up businesses with all women. I do blame like reading the Babysitter's Club, like as a child. It was like, yes, of course, this is like clearly the model for like how to do things.
Which babysitter did you identify with?
Marianne. So much Marianne. Yeah, but like wanted to be Claudia, but like was not cool enough.
Everybody wanted to be Claudia.
She's just too cool. Yeah, yeah.
Even the way she put clothes together, wasn't it? You know, weren't there always long paragraphs about how like Claudia threw this thing over this thing and then put on like a paint spattered jumper and rolled up the sleeves and she always looked amazing.
Yeah, and she made her own jewellery and she was just like fabulous.
And probably like she would look terrible. I've made jewellery myself and it never looked good.
No, but, like, she was like super artistic. Mm-hmm, there is like a blog on the interwebs called What Claudia Wore, which just details like her outfits. It's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. And like, it's funny because like the you know, the writer of the series, Anna Martin, is like, you know, so very much not interested in like the clothing at all. Like she's like real kind of like simple, plain sort of like outfits, you know, like very much kind of a Christie or a Marianne pre-makeover. And
now we're getting really deep.
Marianne's makeover, number 60 in the Babysitter's Club series.
Was it really?
It was, yes.
She didn't get a makeover for 60 books?
Well,
I mean, if she was due a makeover, 60 books seems an extreme number.
You know, like, she did have sort of, like, kind of a mini makeover, but it wasn't described as, like, a makeover. Like, this makeover was, like, sort of
to get rid of her glasses.
Thing. Like, she didn't have glasses. Oh my God, yeah.
How can you have a makeover without a pair of glasses?
Like, and like, just like sort of undoing your ponytail. I know.
Can't imagine it.
Yeah, but like, she did get sort of like her hair cut into this like sort of new kind of trendy style. And I think sort of like maybe had like sort of like a red flared dress. I mean, not that like I'm obsessed with those books or anything. I believe we were talking about work, but like.
Yeah, we were talking about work. Okay, but Big Smoke. So why did you like. Why did the idea come about, or why did you feel it was needed, if you know what I mean?
So at the time, and I mean, there were originally sort of like more people kind of involved, and, you know, particularly sort of at like sort of discussion stage, you know, the part where sort of like it seems like sort of it'll be kind of like a fun thing to do before you realize like all the work is going to go into it. And it was basically just, you know, to do with sort of uncertainty around arts funding for kind of other kind of organizations that were, I suppose, that people would have been sort of teaching with. And it kind of seemed, I suppose, like a good time for people that were, you know, sort of like teaching creative writing to think about, okay, like sort of would it make sense to have, you know, sort of a more sort of like collective kind of system whereby it's actually really like the Babysitter's Club, okay? Except instead of like, you know, sort of like, instead of babysitting, it's creative writing. It is very much, you know, okay, like sort of like, you know, you might have, say, like somebody kind of in beginners who's like, you know, sort of like really into the poetry, but like that's not like really a thing that you specialize in. So you could be like, okay, I'm going to recommend you to like my poet colleague over here, and like, you know, kind of getting to do that and getting to like organize classes in a way that that works best for creative writing, because like there's a lot of stuff where, say, like, you know, operating the same way that maybe like, you know, sort of a traditional kind of adult education class might work, for example, just isn't going to be sort of like the ideal, you know, or having say, like, you know, like 30 or 40 people kind of in a workshop. That's not a workshop, that's a lecture. Mm-hmm. You know, like you need sort of small groups, you need your biscuits, you know. Really, it was all about the biscuits.
The biscuits, sure. Yeah. I did a creative writer, a 4-week kind of intro to creative, I think it was intro to creative writing course a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
But I only made it, there were four classes, I think I made it two, which was devastating. But I'm very flaky. I'm a very flaky human. But the biscuits were a big perk.
It's, you know, you need that sort of sugar fix.
There were Cadbury's chocolate fingers.
Yeah.
That's a high caliber biscuit.
It's really crucial.
Yeah. High demand.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me about which kind of, like, what kind of courses do you offer, and what are the group sizes if you're saying 30 or 40 is too big?
Yeah, so we would usually go for 12 to 15 as a maximum. And sometimes we would run, like, if we were running something sort of quite specialist. So, like, I would do, say, maybe sort of like workshops, like in, like, specializing in like children's and young adult fiction. You might have a group of, say, 7 or 8, you know.
Okay.
But like that would be sort of situations where people are like bringing in kind of long extracts of work, and we're discussing it with sort of like a general sort of beginner class, so like sort of 4-week intro or a 6-week intro, which we do a lot of, because, you know, I think like I think sort of everybody can kind of get something out of like that level of creative writing. Like, it's not necessarily like, you know, we never kind of assume that like everybody's here because they want to, you know, sort of like write a bestseller, like some people do. But like, you know, sometimes it is just like, I want to get out of the house. I want to sort of get back in touch with my creativity.
Yeah.
And like I do think we are all natural storytellers, you know, like we all do that. Like, we, like, if we have a crappy day at work, like we turn it into a story for, you know, like sort of our mates in the pub.
My therapist is always, giving out is the wrong word, because she never really, she's very judgment free in a kind of annoying way that I'm like, what are you trying to say? You know what I mean? So she's never criticizing me.
Stop being so like ethical and professional. Yeah. And just tell
stop
me.
Stop being so neutral. Just give out to me already. Just scold me. But she basically will often try to get me to retell something where she'll go, okay, that was the fun version. So tell me that again. And like, tell me how it affected you, and tell me, rather than, you know, so like I'll be telling her a fun story about how, oh my God, I did this and I did that and it ended really tragically. And then she'll be like, okay, well, that was very, very entertaining, but do you want to try again?
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah. And it's really challenging, because, I mean, it's something that I kind of do, you know, that like that kind of Nora Ephron cliche now that's like everything is copy. But I absolutely do that, to the point of kind of self-sabotage, where I will go on a date with somebody that I kind of don't really want to go on a date, but because I think they're probably a bit mad, you know, putting myself in probably dangerous situations where I'm trying to get the story, or I'm trying to figure out the backstory, or just kind of, I mean, a lot of it kind of does revolve around dating, where I think there are a lot of times when I should be going, that's enough, I never want to speak to you again. And I'm going, tell me more for my story. But one of the things that I found really helpful and useful from the two classes that I went to was,
that's all textbooks. just two classes.
I'm going to be the next E.L. James, which is basically what I'm aiming for now. Lots of money and not a lot of skill. But was kind of the idea that you don't need to be writing anything to write. So like, often I'll be like, I must sit down and write a book, or like work on a book, or work on this. Whereas it really reminded me that you can sit down for 10 minutes and write, and that's writing, and that's valuable, in the same way that working on a project can be valuable. And I guess it's because, you know, we probably do think about our time and our output in terms of what the result is going to be. So like, what's the point in doing this unless you're going to get a book out of it? What's the point in knitting unless you're going to knit a scarf? But it was that kind of reminder that you need to practice, and the way to practice is just to sit down and write. And I found that so useful.
Yeah, I mean, I think like we live in a world where we're obsessed with productivity, you know, and like sort of emphasis on the product. And a lot of writing it's the process, and it's getting kind of used to that process, and it's giving yourself a bit of time to kind of to play with it as well, and to be thinking, you know, okay, I'm doing this because I enjoy it, you know. Like, I always kind of compare it to like going to the gym, and I don't know why I do that, because like I never go to the gym, you know. So like, it's kind of like I'm just gonna try to put this in like terms that you might understand. Whereas really I'm like, I don't know. It's I hear people get like sort of a buzz out of it. But it's that thing like when you're, you know, when you're doing it, like you're enjoying it, you're getting something out of it, like it's not gonna like sort of like, you know, sort of like completely transform your life or anything like that. But like, you're in kind of a better place when you're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
And then you've done something, like you've achieved something, even if it is like only like the 10 minutes, you know? And it is kind of important, and it does it does matter, you know?
Mm, yeah. And I mean, it was just a really nice, you know, I know everyone talks about the importance of mindfulness and the importance of meditation. And
well,
I
did you know that, like, you know, mindfulness will just, it'll cure everything.
Mindfulness will cure cancer. You heard it here, not first, but 117th. But there is something unavoidably mindful about sitting down and writing.
Yeah.
Because you can't do anything else. You know what I mean? And like I'm very bad or good at multi-screening. Yeah. So it's very rare that I would be doing just one thing. I'm listening to a podcast and I'm walking, or I'm watching TV and I'm ticking things off my to-do list, or I'm writing something while I'm on the train. You know that, yeah. I'm very rarely doing one thing. Whereas with writing, unless, I mean, if you don't count like being at a coffee shop and drinking coffee, you can't be doing anything else.
Yeah. Yeah,
no, you can't even listen to music, because then I just write down the stupid lyrics.
Yeah, or you realize that like you're describing like the music video for the thing, and it's like, oh my god, this you know, sort of scene is so romantic. Wait, no, that was
like, this is the best short story I've ever written, and then you realize you're just writing like the whole narrative of the OC because you're listening to that awful California song. I would never listen to that song. But you know what I mean?
I find it interesting that like because the OC also popped into my head, but I was actually thinking more like covers of Hallelujah. And like,
oh,
you know,
yeah. The OC actually had a good soundtrack. It had that really good Placebo cover of Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill.
Oh, excellent.
Do you remember? Was was that when Ryan was in the cage fight? The OC was ridiculous. Or was it when Marissa got run over?
Oh,
I think it was the cage fight.
Yeah, I think it was kind of early-ish.
I think Hallelujah was maybe when she got run over.
Or I think so. I think Hallelujah like sort of is like something with... No, I think that
it was
might...
when she OD'd in Tijuana.
Oh, overdosed. Yeah. There we go. And it's like Ryan sort of like carrying her sort of like, you know, sort of like kind of like Pieta style.
Yeah. God, it was a beautiful scene, actually. But we're going to wrap up shortly, but I actually realized you're probably a really good person to ask for, like, I will frequently tell people that I like kind of shitty teen TV. What are you watching these days?
I am doing a serious rewatch of Grey's Anatomy on Amazon Prime, because, you know, like a bit of medical drama, why not? And
I've never seen Grey's Anatomy, but I literally... All I know about Grey's Anatomy is things I've seen on the internet with people going, every episode makes me cry. And I'm like, I cry every second day anyway. I don't know if I need Grey's Anatomy in my life right now. So I've kind of avoided it.
Yeah, you know, like, no, I don't think it's that high on the sort of on the cryometer, you know, but it's like, it's good. It's like, you know, there's like a lot of, you know, like sort of smart and kind of fabulous women in it. So it's like, yeah, okay, kind of liking this.
Oh, yeah, and yeah. I do like Shonda Rhimes.
Yeah, and like, you know, like Sandra Oh for the 10 seasons that she's in it, mm-hmm. is like just kind of amazing and fabulous and wonderful. I need to get into Killing Eve, which
I've never seen Killing Eve, and that's on my list as well.
It is on my list. I have like the DVD of season one. It has been like given to me as a, like, you know, sort of like, you need to watch this. I'm really hoping the friend that gave it to me is not listening to this going, I judge you so harshly.
She's probably at home going, god, you know, Claire must be just about ready to give me back that box set now. She has to have watched it by now.
Yeah, you know, so it was like such a thoughtful sort of thing for me to do. Yeah, and I do a lot of rewatching. I think because I like to tell myself that it's like, you know, so that I can like analyze for like structural kind of things. But I think mostly it's like a comfort thing.
I was just about to say, it's very comforting, and it's also not hugely taxing.
Yeah.
Because you know the storyline. So it doesn't matter if somebody calls to the door or if you get a text. Got a text. Are you watching Love Island? You're better. You're a better person.
I'm so sorry. I know, like, it's...
Don't apologize for being highbrow, Claire. That's absolutely fine.
I can be, I have other lowbrow interests.
I'm sure you do, but listen, like, Love Island doesn't need to be one of them. You have plenty. Thank you so much.
It's been great.
For taking the time to come and chat to me. Is there anything you'd like to plug other than, can people pick up, is there a new issue of Banshee out?
There's a new issue of Banshee coming out in the autumn, and we're also, it'll be number 9, which is very exciting. And we're also bringing out our first book, which is called Paris Syndrome by Lucy Sweeney Byrne. So those will be out in the world kind of September, October.
Okay, brilliant. And Big Smoke is just bigsmokewritingfactory.com?
It is indeed, yes.
So you can check out the courses that are available there. If people would like to get in touch with you, Would you like them to, or would you like to stay hidden?
I like the humans. Yeah, the humans are great. So I have a website at clairehennessy.com, and I'm on Twitter far too frequently at C Hennessy Books. That's Hennessy spelt like the cognac, but sadly no relation.
That is kind of sad. And actually, Claire's Twitter is very good for recommendations of books, but also recommendations of women to follow and like women to be interested in. I find you're kind of inspiringly supportive of women online, which really nice.
I feel validated as a human now. Thank you.
Well, that was the whole purpose of you being here. Thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so at Rosemary McCabe with the aforementioned A in my Mac. You can support me, patreon.com/Rosemary McCabe with an A in my Mac. And you can also do me a favor, rate and review on iTunes, because that helps other people to find it. And also, when I was showing my aunt how to download podcasts the other day, she was momentarily kind of impressed at the fact that I had a 4.5 star rating on iTunes. So I really need that not to go down, because she'll tell the whole family. Liam Geraghty is my producer. You can listen to his podcast, Meet Your Maker, at meetyourmaker.ie or wherever you get your podcasts. And he recently won 2 bronze medals at some really fancy New York radio awards for his podcast, Meet Your Maker, and for his other kind of drama horror podcast called Petrified, which you can also find wherever you get your podcasts. And I want an award now, because I'm feeling very ill done by. Thank you so much, and I will catch you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.